Imagine you're standing in the middle of your city, right? And there's this massive, ultra-modern skyscraper being built.
Bogoya.
Like, the shiny glass exterior is going up at lightning speed. They've already got helicopter landing pad on the roof. And, the whole thing just looks like an absolute marvel of the future.
Right.
But if you walk down to the street level and you look really closely, the concrete foundation is cracking.
Wow.
Yeah, it's literally buckling under the immense, unexpected weight of all that rapid innovation. And today, well, we are looking at the cracking foundation of the tech world.
We really are.
Because we've got an advanced look at the Techin Morning Global Tech and Innovation Brief. The official drop is this Sunday, June 20, 2026, but we have it today on Friday. And the overarching theme across all these stories is basically structural panic.
Yeah, panic is the right word.
We are exploring what actually happens when wildly disruptive technology collides head-on with the massive traditional institutions we rely on, right? Like Wall Street, Hollywood, NASA, and ultimately, public trust.
It's the perfect setup for what we're going to examine today in this deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, we love to focus on the shiny glass, the new AI models, the crypto bull runs, the Mars missions.
Yeah, the fun stuff.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But we rarely look at the concrete until it is stressed to the absolute breaking point. And the six stories we pulled from your briefing, well, they reveal a fascinating paradox.
Cheers.
As our technology scales exponentially, the physical, financial, and even cultural infrastructure meant to support it
Yeah.
is undergoing massive, sometimes deeply painful, transformations.
So let's start with the financial infrastructure, specifically how traditional money is trying to structurally absorb disruptive tech.
Okay.
We have a massive move today, June 19th, 2026, from Franklin Templeton. And, this is an asset management titan. They control about $1.78 trillion.
A staggering amount of money.
Right. And they just filed an SEC application for something they are calling Bitcoin DRIP ETFs. The projected launch date is September 1st. Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
They are taking cash dividends from S&P 500 giants and automatically rolling them into Bitcoin exposure. So is this basically like putting training wheels on a motorcycle? You get the wild high-speed ride of crypto, but with the safety harness of a regulated traditional brokerage account.
It's an interesting analogy, but I'd actually frame it a bit differently. It's more like putting a governed speed limiter on a sports car.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because it isn't just about keeping the retail investor safe, you know? It is about making a highly volatile asset behave predictably enough for Wall Street's massive internal architecture to actually digest it.
Predictable crypto, that's an oxymoron.
Well, what's fascinating here is the strategic shift away from active speculative trading toward passive, relentless accumulation. I mean, if you look at the mechanics, traditional DREs, dividend reinvestment plans, they're designed to compound wealth quietly over decades.
Right. Set it and forget it.
Exactly. By redirecting the cash dividends from companies like, say, Apple or Johnson & Johnson into a Bitcoin ETF, Franklin Templeton is trying to change Bitcoin's core identity in the traditional portfolio.
Right, because historically, conservative investors, maybe even you listening right now, have avoided crypto because of the operational friction.
Oh, absolutely.
Like managing private keys, worrying about exchange hacks, navigating all those regulatory gray zones, it's just exhausting. But this SEC-regulated vehicle completely abstracts that away.
Makes it invisible.
Yeah. But the scale of the liquidity we were talking about is what really caught my eye here. I mean, the S&P 500 pays out something like $500 billion in dividends annually.
Right. Let's just think about the market mechanics of that for a second. If even a fraction of that $500 trillion annual flow is automatically blindly funneled into these Bitcoin DRIPs every single quarter, you are creating a sustained price-agnostic demand floor.
Wow. Price agnostic.
Yeah. These aren't day traders trying to time the top. These are automated algorithms buying Bitcoin exposure, whether the market is up 20% or down 20%.
They don't care.
They don't care at all. It tethers the crypto ecosystem directly to the quarterly corporate earnings cycles of traditional blue chip America. It is arguably the most significant bridge built between Wall Street and decentralized finance to date.
Which honestly makes the transition to our next story incredibly jarring.
It really does.
Because while Wall Street is currently engineering ways to pour billions of dollars of institutional liquidity into the investment layer of crypto, the actual underlying infrastructure of the second largest crypto network is quietly going broke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The contrast is just staggering. I mean, we go from a $1.78 trillion asset manager to a literal public goods funding crisis.
Yeah.
Trent Van Epps, who is a former contributor to the Ethereum Foundation, issued a really stark warning. He said that Ethereum's core developers are facing a severe budget shortage that could hit within the next 3 to 9 months.
I genuinely had to double take when reading the brief on this.
I know, right?
Because the upper layers of Ethereum, the decentralized exchanges, the lending protocols, the NFTs, they are processing billions of dollars.
Billions.
Yet the sources note it costs only about $30 million annually to maintain the core protocol.
Which is practically a rounding error for Wall Street.
Exactly. And that $30 million covers critical network security, bug bounties, and the heavy lifting research for major upgrades like the Merge or Dinkin.
Right.
And then there's the client incentive program, which was historically used to fund developers working on essential clients like Death and Nethermind. That expired back in April 2026.
Yeah, it just vanished.
So I have to ask, wait, the upper layers of Ethereum are making billions, but they can't find $30 million to pay the people actually keeping the lights on. How is the foundation of a decentralized financial revolution living paycheck to paycheck?
It perfectly illustrates the tragedy of the commons, especially in open source decentralized networks.
Also,
well, when you don't have a traditional corporate structure with a centralized revenue extraction model like, you know, a CEUVO, an HR department, and a payroll system, funding public goods infrastructure becomes a logistical nightmare.
Right, because nobody is technically in charge of paying the bills.
Exactly. Everyone building on top of Ethereum just assumes the base layer runs itself.
Yeah.
But the reality is that highly specialized human beings have to write the code, patch the zero-day exploits, and physically secure the network's future.
And if the funding dries up, the network doesn't just, like, freeze in place safely. It stagnates. And more importantly, it becomes incredibly vulnerable.
Highly vulnerable.
Like, if you can't pay your top tier cryptographers and engineers, they are going to leave for heavily funded private tech companies.
Precisely. It really shatters the old Silicon Valley mantra of build it and they will come.
Yeah.
Building it is only the first step. Maintaining it requires a sustainable economic engine.
So what are they doing about it?
Well, the community is now forced to debate these highly complex solutions. Do they rely on larger sporadic grants from whales?
Which is basically charity.
Right. Or do they implement on-chain funding? Like essentially taxing a portion of network transaction fees to pay developers. Or do they solicit corporate support, which risks centralizing power in the hands of a few massive entities who foot the bill?
That goes against the whole ethos of crypto.
It does. It's a massive existential question for decentralized governance.
And ignoring foundational infrastructure isn't just a crypto problem. In fact, that exact same rush to build the shiny upper layers while neglecting the concrete foundation is causing an active multi-server catastrophe in the AI space right now.
Oh, absolutely. The Langflow situation is the perfect example of technical debt instantly turning into a five-alarm security fire.
Yeah.
According to the brief, over 7,000 servers running Langflow, LangGraph, and LangChain are currently under active coordinated attack.
7,000. And for those of you who track the AI development space, you know Langflow is a hugely popular low-code platform.
It's very popular.
It's what developers and startups use to rapidly prototype AI applications and connect large language models to their own databases. But the vulnerability they're being hit with is brutal.
It's bad.
It's logged as CVE-2026-SHIZO-27. It carries an 8.8 out of 10 severity score, and it allows for remote code execution.
Which basically means an attacker isn't just crashing the application, right? They are owning the entire server.
The keys to the castle.
Yeah. They can execute arbitrary commands. They can exfiltrate sensitive API keys, dump your proprietary databases, or even weaponize your compute power to launch further attacks. But the mechanics of how this happened are what we really need to look at.
Right.
This wasn't a highly sophisticated, unpreventable zero-day exploit requiring nation-state resources.
No, not at all. Here's where it gets really interesting. The root cause, according to the sources, is that developers rushed to adopt AI so fast that they left default configurations completely exposed to the public internet without proper hardening.
Unbelievable.
It's literally like a company building a state-of-the-art billion-dollar AI mansion, but leaving the front door wide open with the master key resting right there on the welcome mat.
It's the reality of shadow IT in the AI boom, you know?
Yeah.
The open source tooling we have today is remarkable because it democratizes development.
Sure.
A mid-level developer can spin up a complex AI integration in an afternoon. But because the mandate from the top is always, like, faster, faster, deploy AI faster, These prototypes are being pushed to production environments without ever looping in the cybersecurity teams.
They just bypass them entirely.
Completely. The rigorous auditing, the safe default settings, the network isolation, all of that foundational security infrastructure is being entirely ignored for the sake of speed.
So if you or your engineering teams are utilizing these stacks, the directive from the briefing is immediate triage.
Yes. Do not wait.
You need to check your environment versions right now. Running Pipshow Langflow is the first step. Update to the patched versions immediately.
And assume you've already been compromised.
Exactly. Assume compromise. Scan your server logs for the past 72 hours looking for any unauthorized access patterns. Isolate those instances. Rotate all your credentials. And enhance your firewalls to restrict management endpoints exclusively to whitelisted IPs.
It is a harsh, expensive lesson.
Yeah.
But, you know, that rushing of AI development doesn't just create technical backdoors. It creates massive financial conflicts of interest.
Oh, big time.
When we look at the sheer velocity of capital flooding into the AI sector, it starts to warp everything around it, including our cultural infrastructure.
Which brings us to the story that I honestly haven't stopped thinking about since I read it.
It's a crazy one.
Amazon MGM Studios just completely shelved a film titled Artificial. And let's be clear about the scale here. This wasn't some experimental indie film. No. This was a nearly finished movie with a $40 to $60 million budget.
Yeah.
It was directed by Luca Guadagnino. It was written by Beau Willimon, the creator of House of Cards, by the way.
Yeah.
And it starred Andrew Garfield playing OpenAI's Sam Altman.
The pedigree on this project was just massive.
Huge.
It was set up to be a tense, high-stakes corporate thriller dramatizing that chaotic five-day period back in November 2023 when Sam Altman was unexpectedly fired by the OpenAI board and then rapidly reinstated.
Right.
It was meant to be the definitive cultural document of that exact moment.
But, and here's the catch, Amazon recently made a $50 billion strategic investment in OpenAI. $50
billion. Yeah, with a B.
And suddenly, releasing a film that might portray the internal governance, the executive dynamics, or the overall stability of your most important strategic partner in a dramatic light, well, that becomes an unacceptable business risk.
It's a liability.
So the film gets locked in a vault. But I have to push back on how quietly this is being normalized.
Okay.
Because we rely on art, on cinema, and literature to help us process huge historical moments. If the mega corporations building our AI future also happen to own the movie studios and distribution platforms, are we just never going to get an honest story about them?
This raises an important question about media independence. But let me challenge that premise slightly.
Sure.
It's not that independent filmmakers will stop making critical art. The bottleneck is the distribution oligopoly. I mean, if we look at this strictly through the lens of the business logic presented in the text, Amazon's decision is entirely rational.
From a pure spreadsheet perspective, sure.
Right. You do not jeopardize a $50 billion foundational technology partnership over a $50 million piece of entertainment content. The math is simple.
But the societal math is terrifying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When the entities pouring capital into the tech are the exact same entities, greenlighting and distributing the cultural reflections of that tech, self-censorship basically becomes a systemic feature of the industry.
Yeah.
It means the public's right to transparent storytelling regarding AI governance is secondary to corporate synergy. It dictates the boundaries of the narratives you're even allowed to consume.
It's chilling because big tech's reach is dictating our financial flows, our IT infrastructure, our media. And now, according to our next source, they are literally expanding to other planets.
Yeah, the transition from controlling earthly narratives to controlling Martian exploration is seamless, apparently.
Right.
NASA has officially announced it is outsourcing the Eolus Mars orbiter, which is slated for a 2028 launch. And the partner they selected is Relativity Space, a private aerospace company led by former Google CEO Eric Schmidt.
Now, Relativity Space is already known in the industry for utilizing advanced 3D printing to manufacture rockets, which is cool.
Very cool.
But the significance of this briefing isn't the manufacturing technique. It's the scope of the contracting model.
Yes.
Because this marks the very first time NASA has delegated an entire scientific Mars mission to a private company. We aren't just talking about building a launch vehicle. We are talking about the initial design, the 3D printed manufacturing, the launch logistics, and the ongoing mission control operations.
They handed over the keys. And the scientific payload of Eolus is critical for our long-term goals.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Up until now, our atmospheric data from Mars has largely been localized, you know, gathered by rovers in specific craters.
Right.
Or it's just been highly sporadic.
Right. Not very comprehensive.
Right. But EOLIS is designed to provide the first continuous daily global measurements of Mars's atmospheric dynamics and weather patterns.
Which is huge.
It is. If humanity is ever going to establish physical bases on the Martian surface, we absolutely require a daily planetary weather forecast. You have to be able to predict severe dust storms and those extreme thermal fluctuations.
So if NASA used to be the general contractor building the house brick by brick, are they now just the wealthy client who picks a design out of a catalog and says, build this for me?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it represents exactly that shift from cost-plus contracting to fixed-price service procurement.
Okay.
NASA is adapting to a new economic reality. By leveraging the speed, the iterative risk-taking, and the manufacturing innovations of the private sector, like 3D printing an entire fuselage, NASA can stretch its finite congressional budget much further.
Makes sense.
But it also signals a fundamental paradigm shift. The brightest executive minds and the deepest pools of capital from Silicon Valley are no longer content just optimizing software algorithms. They are actively funding the physical exploration of the solar system.
It is an incredible leap forward in capabilities. But as we've seen woven through every single story in this deep dive, whether you are launching a rocket to Mars, rushing an AI deployment, or rolling out a massive piece of entertainment, your ultimate currency, your absolute foundation, is public trust.
Always. And when you break that trust, the cost is staggering.
Yeah.
You don't just bounce back the next fiscal quarter. The recovery process is agonizingly slow, and it requires a fundamental operational pivot, which, well, brings us to our final story regarding the gaming studio CD Projekt Red.
Right. Their co-CEO, Maka Nowakowski, recently sat down for a highly candid interview with IGN, and he openly admitted that the company is still recovering from the catastrophic launch of Cyberpunk 2077.
Which happened all the way back in December 2020.
Yeah, over 5 years ago at this point.
And for context, that launch wasn't just a disappointment. It was a historic industry debacle.
Oh, it was a mess.
The game shipped riddled with severe game-breaking bugs, particularly on older generation consoles. The performance was so abysmal that Sony took the unprecedented step of removing the game entirely from the PlayStation Store.
Which never happens.
Never. And CD Projekt Red watched their stock plummet by 75% almost overnight.
Ouch. The word Nowakowski used to describe the internal feeling was heartbreaking.
I bet.
But the lesson here isn't just the failure, it's the anatomy of the recovery. Because they didn't abandon the IP.
No, they doubled down.
They spent years completely rebuilding the foundation of the game engine. They pushed out over 20 major patches, completely overhauling the mechanics, which eventually culminated in the highly acclaimed Phantom Liberty expansion in September 2023.
A huge turnaround.
It was. And now, as they are deep in development for their next mainline game, Witcher 4, they are operating under a radically cautious mandate.
Very cautious.
They are optimizing strictly for current-gen hardware, so the PS5, Xbox Series X and S, and high-end PCs, and they have publicly sworn they will not release the game until it is genuinely ready, regardless of the marketing calendar. So, what does this all mean? Can a massive technology or gaming company ever truly wash off a reputation-destroying failure of that magnitude? Or does that scar just become a permanent part of their corporate DNA?
The scar becomes permanent, but it acts as an operational immune system.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. What CD Projekt Red went through is basically a masterclass in crisis management for the entire technology sector. The original sin in 2020 was allowing the marketing department and the board of directors to dictate the engineering release schedule.
Yep. Putting the cart before the horse.
Exactly. And the lesson is that you cannot patch a broken reputation with an apology tweet or a slick PR campaign.
Right.
Rebuilding trust requires years of uncomfortable transparency, consistent communication, and a structural shift toward prioritizing product quality over quarterly financial expectations. It is a grueling multi-year marathon.
And that reality perfectly synthesizes everything we have unpacked today. I mean, from Franklin Templeton building a bridge to quietly absorb corporate dividends into Bitcoin, to the hidden financial fragility threatening the developers of Ethereum.
Yeah.
We've examined the glaring real-time security holes in our rushed AI infrastructure and how that same influx of AI capital is allowing tech giants to reshape Hollywood narratives and even fund Martian weather satellites. Through it all, the painful, years-long lesson of CD Projekt Red serves as a warning about the fragility of public trust.
The sheer velocity and scale of these structural shifts are what make this specific briefing so vital.
Exactly. And to you listening right now, the biggest takeaway is recognizing that these aren't just abstract headlines floating around in some distant tech sphere.
Not at all.
These fundamental shifts are directly impacting your reality right now. They are reshaping the mechanics of your retirement portfolio. They are dictating the security of your personal data on corporate servers. And they are literally filtering the media and art you have access to.
And it leaves us with one final overarching thought to ponder long after this discussion ends.
Let's hear it.
We've seen today that massive tech companies and their executives are increasingly the ones funding our decentralized financial infrastructure, controlling our cinematic narratives, and physically building our rockets to Mars. It makes you wonder. As the line between sovereign government responsibilities and tech monopolies continues to blur, who will ultimately be the ones regulating the regulators in the next decade?
Wow, that is the defining question of our era and one we are all going to have to face. Thank you so much for joining us on this exploration today. Stay insanely curious, keep a close eye on the concrete foundation beneath the glass skyscraper, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.